Next up is activist Carol Denny, who I caught on the phone. She's up in Berkeley. She writes for Street Spirit and a number of other publications. I first met her as an activist years ago in People's Park when she was fighting the University of California's attempt to destroy the user-developed area and take it over for their own use. She's been giving us regular reports, and this is another one of them. Okay, well, I have on the line Carol Denny, I don't know her middle name, but someday I will, of Berkeley, California, who is a writer, activist, musician, and probably many other things. But right now I'm trying to find out what's been going on at the Berkeley shitty council meetings, if you'll forgive me for being adolescent. I believe there was one a couple days ago. Hi, Carol.
Yes, there was. Tuesday night, the Berkeley City Council there's one magnificent thing that just happened. At least this is the first city council meeting where I have seen the return of the drum. This is a drum that I remember so well many years. Sure, our former mayor, Shirley Dean, used to put all of the speaker's cards in and then ceremoniously turn and pull them out at random. The drum is back. So our new mayor, Jesse Araquin, pulled 10 cards, I guess, to speak on non-agendized issues in the beginning of the meeting. I thought that was pretty funny. But the main thing they did after that, which I found revolting, was they celebrated.
Before you get to that, Carol, explain the difference between the return of the drum and what has been the practice for the last, I don't know, for however how long, as far as getting people to speak on items not on the agenda.
Oh, man, that should be a PhD treatise. The way public comment has changed over and over and over through it, not just through each and every administration, but from meeting to meeting. It was really, really something, and apparently Jesse Araquin is having his fun as well. How long one gets to speak depends on how many people show up to speak, but at least these days, you don't have to try to figure out which side of an issue you on as though everything on Earth were binary. So this is news to me that 10 people get to speak before the meeting begins, 10 and only 10, and then they move to the agenda and apparently have a middle-of-the-night public comment section. And also, they've unveiled an online session so that people can Twitter in from home. So I am not the expert right now. Just like hold on to your seatbelts for the new era of public comment.
Well, what was it? Let's say in January and February, was it the same as it is now, or did it change?
It has changed a little bit. The drum is news to me. The drum was not happening in the last few months. So now the return of the drum is really comic from my comedic.
So previously it was first come, first served, and they had only 10?
Really. It was, you kind of lined up and took turns, and you could cede time to someone who needed a little more time to finish a thought. It's been a little bit informal, which has so far worked out pretty well.
And they were allowed only a 10-minute or whatever beginning of the city council deal, and then everything else was shoved to the middle of the night? Or
no, that's not the best explanation. They have non-agendized items. There's a public comment opportunity for non-agendized items. That would be anything you want to talk about. But clearly what the drum does is put a finite amount of people in there. And so it, I think what they're trying to do is make sure that isn't 2 hours of just random poetry reading.
Now, was that what it was before? Yeah. Was that your experience?
No, it wasn't. People are eager to speak about topics on the agenda, but sometimes the city council will stop you and insist that you are straying from the point. So I see the point of the city council trying to make sure that the meetings don't go on to 4 a.m., but the drum is... The drum has its comedy. And then they move to agenda items where the only way they constrain public comment is to constrain the amount of time you get to speak, the smallest amount of time being 1 minute. Sometimes they go to two. Usually there's too many people there to go to three.
You know,
I've been to a couple of Berkeley City Council meetings, so that was last year.
Spent entirely too much time here asking Carol to go through the details of the public comment. It's always a matter of interest to me because at City Council we struggle to public comment at oral communications, which is what she's talking about, items not on the agenda, is the only opportunity for people to bring up real issues, mostly, that the City Council chooses to ignore. Not that it makes a lot of difference, though. That's always the contradiction. But insofar as we find ourselves down at City Council and we want to speak, it's useful to, and sometimes amusing in a kind of a sardonic, dark way, to look at the way City Council is increasingly constricting, our City Council, that is, public comment. As I think I mentioned on this, in this program earlier, at the last City Council meeting, which was last Tuesday, on the, I guess it was the 4th of April, there was only one speaker at oral communication, but he was only allowed 2 minutes. Even though there was nobody else, and the usual time for oral communication is 30 minutes. At the previous meeting, the week before, there had been, I think, 6 or 7 speakers, and people had, again, only been allowed 2 minutes, even though the total time was 30 minutes. I still really didn't get a clear notion of what the current change in the Berkeley City Council was, except that they have reinstituted the drum, which is apparently a barrel where they choose 10 names out of the barrel, and those 10 people get to speak. I think they get to speak first, and then other people, if they want, can speak at the end of the Berkeley City Council meeting, but I'm not sure, because I don't think we actually got to that, though maybe we did, who knows. Let's hear a little more.
The reason I kind of harp on this point is we have this new mayor as well, Cynthia Chase, who at the public comment section on Tuesday, we had one speaker who was allowed to speak for 2 minutes. And what she was doing in the previous two week before, we had our council meetings were piling up on each other. We usually, it's every 2 weeks. But she said, you know, that she would allow only 2 minutes per speaker, even though the conventional period here was 30 minutes for total. And in other words, people were being cut off right and left. And we're talking, of course, about the area when the item's not on the agenda, which often are the most important items, because they don't get on the agenda, as you know.
Yes.
But the issue, I guess, I'm still not entirely clear. Before the drum situation, on the items not on the agenda issue before the main meeting, or, you know, at the beginning of the meeting,
how much time would depend on, this is still the case, how much time depends on how many cars go in. So the 10 speakers are limited at this point. At least that was my assessment, just paying attention as best I could on Tuesday. They are limiting the speakers from off the agenda before the agendized items to 10 through the use of the drum.
And before
how long they get to speak probably depends on how many cards are in the drum.
And before it was any number of speakers, but only for a limited time?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sorry to drag that one out.
There was much abuse of that. Mm-hmm. The lengthier lines usually come for agendized items, usually one horror story after another, as is often the case up here.
Okay.
But before that, they did a ceremonial item of congratulating, like really spending a lot of time thanking the police officers and the city staff from Public Works, who swept the homeless camps over and over and over from around Thanksgiving on through past Christmas. These people were individually called out and commended for their work. And so they did that. This, you know, this is Jesse Adagin, who styles himself, you know, friend of the homeless and the harbinger of a new era where they're not going to use police and public works to try to address homelessness. But boy, that is what's happening. So it was an ill omen for what came later, which was, of course, the passage of this project they call the Pathways Project, which is essentially a name. It has no location, no budget. It assures, if you read it, it assures everyone, meaning the Downtown Berkeley Association, that it will continue to use the anti-camping ordinances. Berkeley has many useful ordinances when you want to sweep homeless camps or move people along. It assures anybody who reads the Pathways Project that it will continue to use those anti-homeless laws. So I've been writing and writing about this, you know, wasting my time on the phone with city council representatives who, they know where the money falls in this town. The money, you know, you can get reelected if you keep this up. So we have a brand new council that's going to do the same old thing.
And do we have any sense of, in the last couple of months, we know the constant attacks on, at least first they came for the homeless, which has been left alone, the poor tour camp. But other camps I've heard in my occasional travels up to Berkeley have been targeted, I think down on, I don't know, down near the railroad tracks or...
they're all being targeted. Down near the railroad tracks, I know that crew pretty well, and what they do when Caltrans comes is just move. They move an enormous amount of people and materials and even some furniture out of Caltrans Way so Caltrans can do its cleanup, and then they move back. And they're just really, really patient and good about this. I interviewed them up about 3 weeks ago when I was seeing it happen, and it was so beautiful. They said, hey, we figured it out. You know, when we see them coming, we start packing, pick it all up, move it all down here, always make pathways for people to get through, keep smiling. I mean, beautiful souls down there, beautiful, who have just figured out that this is part of trying to make it down there.
So they're not seizing property and destroying it as some other jurisdictions are.
Oh, they still, I shouldn't say that they're not doing that. It's just with this particular crew, because they're willing to move everything and only have as much as they can move, they've figured out how to live in a pretty stable way. Now, this is close to me at the foot of University Avenue as you go past the overpass. Or it's sort of technically under the overpass, so they can stay out of the rain. Well, now, that's not the case up near Gilman. They take people's stuff up there. But the people up there don't move. Where would they go? I mean, they've been moved off of the bulb, off of, like, slowly, they keep being moved closer and closer to Berkeley. And then unless they find some safe harbor, they are just out of luck. It's bad. It's very bad. And, yeah, they destroy people's stuff left and right.
Well, I know that here in Santa Cruz this morning, there was a thing called the Coffee Conversation, which is a sort of a liberal, middle-class, well-intended get-together that's for an hour outside the library, run by a couple of librarians who sort of want to persuade the community that the homeless are less than these bestial creatures that have to, you know, drug-using, mentally ill, bum, and so forth. And it's nice, and it's a 1 hour a week thing, and it's, you know, I went down there for the first time. It's been going for a couple months. But, of course, across the street, we have the nightly sleepouts where the homeless are being targeted all the time at City Hall, because not only are we doing freedom sleepouts...
Across the street from the freedom sleepout.
Yeah, it's where the library is. The library is right across from City Hall. In Santa Cruz. And what's happening every night is that the freedom sleepers... Well, I call them the survival sleepers, because freedom sleepers come once a week, and that's a couple of people from houses.
I see.
And then other people support them with food. But every night, there's at least 5 to 20 people sleeping at City Hall anyway, because they've decided, in essence, to tear up their tickets or use them for the toilet paper that the city doesn't provide.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so it's really a growing resistance movement. It's really civil resistance. I wouldn't even call it civil disobedience, because they're not going to go to court on any of this stuff. They're just going to ignore laws that criminalize survival. But, again, we're talking with Carol Denny of Berkeley, who writes regularly for the Berkeley Daily Planet, an infamous satirical sheet called the Pepper Spray Times, which can be found online.
Uh-huh. And also for Street Spirit.
And for the, I'm going to soon get the latest issue of Street Spirit up in Berkeley.
Buckle your seatbelt.
And you were telling us about the wonderful new program modeled after San Francisco's navigation centers, perhaps, that the Berkeley City Council?
Don't give it that much credit. I mean, it's just a name.
I'm being sarcastic.
When I say it's just a name.
I'm being
sarcastic. No budget, no location, nothing.
Yeah, I'm being sarcastic. My understanding is it's a bunch of horseshit. But, you know, then again, I'm pretty, you know me, I have a rather negative view, generally, of bureaucratic activity or legislative activity, although, you know, with some exceptions. But tell me more about this, if you think anything about this named program. Did every council member fall into line with a big grin on their face and say, what a wonderful program, or were there some...
You know, I saw it coming, and I realized that I was going to explode. So I started to paint and just didn't watch some of it. But they run it again, I think, today. So I'm going to try to pay attention so that I can honestly answer that question in a future program for you. It's just that sometimes I can't bear it. I'm really so angry. I'm very, very pissed off at all of these housing activists who think people can just, press a button somewhere on their jacket and disappear. That must be what they're thinking.
Well, this is the age of extraterrestrial activity, as you know.
Yeah, and I suppose Silicon Valley is working on that jacket for the lesser among us who are going to have to disappear pretty quickly coming soon.
Well, also, on a collateral subject we haven't talked about for a long time, as you know, Proposition 56 kicked in at the beginning of this month, which raised cigarette prices from 87 cents, the tax, that is, to $2.87. What impact do you think this has on the homeless community, if any?
I can tell you that with no small authority. They don't institute these taxes without a whole lot of study on the effects of places that do raise cigarette taxes, namely New York. New York City is the highest tax, at least last time I checked. And what tends to happen is kids don't start until... kids just don't start. When cigarettes are cheap, kids start smoking, really early, like in West Virginia, age 6. Because they're cheap. But when cigarettes get expensive, kids would rather buy bubble gum. You know, they just don't tend to buy... This is all about kids, I got to say. So the effect on a homeless population would be the same effect it has on smokers. I mean, it's almost identical, although there is a higher ratio of people who are on the streets who smoke because they fit all these categories that have a higher ratio of smoking. They're poorer, they're blacker, they experience more mental illness, all kinds of things like that. But they just tend to smoke less, so fewer people smoke. And it's you can argue that it's a good thing, but it is harder to get a cigarette. And there's also usually more contraband cigarettes that will start crossing state lines in states that have lesser taxes. But that was California. People were importing cigarettes from California around here because Utah's really high. I can't remember the surrounding states for us. But usually the impact is about the same on any adult population. You'll have a certain percentage of people who will quit or smoke a whole lot less and probably improve their health along the way. And then the real impact and what the real target of these laws is on kids who don't start. So the longer you can take to protect a growing kid's brain, but the chemicals of drugs and nicotine, the longer chance, the better chance they have of not becoming addicts later in life.
Now, this became a sort of a collateral issue here in Santa Cruz for some homeless activists when the city essentially increased the penalties and increased the areas where no smoking bans in public areas. We're not necessarily talking areas where people actually were, but let's say distant areas in parks where homeless people could be found. And over the last 3 years, there's been a massive increase in the number of citations for smoking by Parks and Rec Rangers here, which has, I think, a total of $200 to $300 fine if you add in all the court costs. Plus, they give you a stay-away order, not from the courts, but from the police department itself, which has created this, the council created a new law which gave rangers and police the power to, once you've been issued a ticket, before you're even charged, you can be given a stay-away order first for a week, then for a day, then a week, then a month, then 6 months. And so it's had, the impact of allowing a lot more selective enforcement of homeless folks. Is that likely to be the case up in Berkeley, or has that been the case up in Berkeley, as far as you know?
So you did that on purpose, didn't you? You think I'm going to fall for that?
No, it's a real question, Carol. I know that in different cities have different laws, so it may not be the case up there.
Okay, so as onerous as you just described it, for a smoker, housed or unhoused, to stroll out of a park to enjoy their cigarette, it is not nearly as onerous as getting cancer. And I, as someone who has had cancer 3 times and is not a smoker, has had to sing in smoky clubs because I'm a musician, and still experiences an enormous amount of secondhand smoke on our supposedly smoke-free streets. I gotta say, the contest between the inconvenience of anyone who is asked only to stroll out of the restricted area, that's usually a commons area, to enjoy their cigarette, will never match the inconvenience of someone who has to go through surgery, chemotherapy, various treatments, including, for me, after each chemotherapy treatment, where I lost all my hair, my eyebrows, my eyelashes, every inch of hair on my body. I also had to give myself shots of Neupogen at home, because in those days, chemotherapy was so severe that it would have killed me. They realized they had to go for the good drugs, the 200-buck-a-day shots of Neupogen, and I had to do that myself at home, where I could barely move. You cannot talk to me about the inconvenience of homeless people or anybody else being asked merely to get up and stroll out of a park compared to what I went through 3 different times and still experience, as I now have. I now have what many people who have been through chemotherapy have, acute reactions to secondhand smoke and smoke of any kind.
Gotcha.
I have to say, When you present this as a terrifying inconvenience and the tickets as ever...
Carol,
let me finish.
Please do, because I want to say something, okay?
Please do remember.
Yeah.
That many, many of the people using that park, walking those streets, trying to get in and out of the stores, trying to attend the meetings, are people like me who suffer acute effects. And the main thing they should worry about isn't even cancer, which I ended up with. It's heart disease. That's the thing that people are creating in others when they are inconsiderate with their secondhand.
Carol, I want to respond to this. You made your point. I mean, I think it's.
Have I made my point?
Yeah, you think you have. I think you have. But I think you did so. You did so by ignoring the question, which was, you know, is there a massive increase, as there is in Santa Cruz, of selective enforcement against homeless people by using the no-smoking ordinance? And that in no way detracts from the validity of everything you're saying. I got to say that. I want to make that really clear. My question was a question that
I can answer you very simply.
Go ahead.
By saying that the only people, homeless or not homeless, who are getting smoking tickets in the city of Berkeley are people who refuse to stroll out of the smoke-free areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not the case in Santa Cruz, so it's a different situation.
Really? Non-smokers are getting tickets? I doubt it very much.
No, people are getting tickets who are in the large greenbelt areas where homeless people have to hide and sleep at night. And they're also...
Is that a smoke-free area?
Yeah.
Well, that's my point, is that all smokers can stroll out of those areas and enjoy a cigarette, and then stroll back so that they don't expose other people. The point of these laws is not to inconvenience a smoker. It's to protect public health.
Right, but you're not familiar with the greenbelt areas in Santa Cruz. They are...
They're smoke-free. I am agreeing with you that...
You have to go pretty...
agreeing with each other.
You have to go pretty deep into a greenbelt area in order to camp without getting fucked with by the police. And the notion that you're going to... You know, leave all your stuff and walk out to take...
You're smoking smoke-free areas. I can't help you.
No, I understand.
The reason that...
Let's leave it. You know,
urban areas are smoke-free is that the impact on public health is profound.
Now, that I think is true. It is also true that in Santa Cruz it is used as a homeless removal device. And that is, the considered opinion of most activists down here. But I think that your point is equally valid. But let me ask you about a guy who... I don't think he died of smoking, but he died at a fairly, advanced age. Mark Hawthorne, the hate man. Any comments about him?
He died of heart disease, which is the primary result of smoking.
Was he a smoker?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
He was very proud of smoking Virginia Slims.
Oh, boy.
Was never without them, and played great games with them, and was insistent that People's Park, which has been smoke-free for about 5 years now, under the University of California's edict, not the city's, because it claims to be owned by the University of California. So he was one of the people who thought his freedom was well represented by not just violating that law, but exposing me, whom he knew to be a cancer survivor. I tried to talk to him about it. He would not listen. He absolutely did not care about the heart disease that he and cancer he was engendering in other people. And all I can say is, if that looks like freedom to some people, I would beg to disagree. Come with me to the cancer ward. Come meet the people who are struggling every day of their lives. Because you can choose to expose yourself and put your own health at risk. Nobody's stopping you, except in smoke-free areas where you run a very strong risk of affecting other people's health. That's what this is really about, and you refuse to see it that way.
Carol, I'm trying to get back to Mark. He's obviously, you're not the person to talk to give him an encomium.
Well, yes,
right?
I am. I'm the one who wrote the Daily Planet's obit. I knew him really well.
Well, let's hear. Yeah.
Think for a minute.
Well, tell me about it.
Because I would spar with him on this obvious point that I didn't love him like a brother.
Tell me about him. Tell us about him a little bit, if you're up for it.
Sure. He was known as the hate man, and he was known as the hate man because he was kind of a philosopher who honestly felt as though if people would just acknowledge how much they couldn't stand each other from time to time, that we'd have a more honest world, and that the communication that came after, the acknowledgement that you can't stand each other, would be freer, would be more self-expressive. And he also Hate Man was his nickname, and he very often, if you said, "Hey man, how you doing? I love your brother," which is kind of the People's Park way, he'd say, "Well, don't tell me that. Tell me you hate me." He challenged people just to be honest about the hatred in their heart, which we all have, at least from time to time. And so it was kind of part game and part philosophy, and he was an educated man, a gentleman, a very inclusive man. He welcomed people to the park, kind of told people the way, and then he also was unwilling to cave into the kind of gentrification of the park. He wore dresses. He wore long skirts and leather gloves and just peculiar clothing, even for Berkeley. Slightly peculiar clothing, so that also became, to me, part of what I love about Berkeley, in that if you get dressed and you're halfway to work and you look down and you think, oh my God, I look terrible today, if you have somebody nearby like Hate Man, you won't worry about it so much, because at least you're not wearing the pink tutu, and he thinks it's a joke anyway, and it's all good. There's something about it that was just wonderful. So he had a bunch of people who would hang with him up in one area of the park, and they did a lot of just sort of philosophical arguing. It was kind of beautiful. And, there were a lot of things he did that people had difficulty with him over, including the University of California police were really pissed off. There's actually a People's Park rule that says you cannot bring a baby stroller into People's Park unless there's a baby in it. And
really?
That was for Hate Man. I'm so glad that that rule still exists. At least I looked it up last night before I wrote the op-ed that I just wrote, because that was for Hate Man. That's how much they couldn't put their arms around how to stop this man's adventurous nature and superlative way of just playing with the world around him, goosing it a little bit along the way. He was a fabulous guy, and I think I called my piece Hate Man, the Pathways Project and the War on Eccentricity, because I truly believe that the war on People's Park in particular and the kind of ungoverned, explosive culture on the south side of campus, especially and across the bay, that kind of united in poetry and music and song, I think the University of California has always been terrified of that, and probably a lot of other people too. It's kind of a Chamber of Commerce thing these days to try to squelch anything that seems eccentric or unconventional. And that's, you know, what Berkeley's famous for, so I consider it a well-matched battle. But Hate Man was a wonderful, gentle warrior in that battle. And even the city council adjourned in his honor on Tuesday, recognizing the role that he played in just making Berkeley a special place.
You're listening to an interview with Carol Denny on Free Radio Santa Cruz, the stream of Free Radio. We'll hear a little bit more after this brief musical interlude.
Church bells are ringing. Families are wearing their Sunday best. Choirs are singing. Red sun is setting in the west. A soldier is yelling, standing tall, checkpoint is closing, outside a giant wall, it's Christmas Eve.
Sidewalk.
people can read your article at the Berkeley Daily Planet website, right?
Yes, it's up there now.
Anything going with People's Park that you want to comment on?
People's Park is on a list of 8 sites that the University of California unveiled as ripe for development. And this, of course, set off a lot of park lovers, People's Park lovers, who are worried that it's that they're going to show up with bulldozers and build housing. And, you know, maybe they will, but it's not quite organizing point as yet. What it always is in a town with this much turnover, like your town, we're a college town, so every year you've got to tell the story again for the freshmen coming in who may have heard of People's Park but don't really know the setting and are ripe for the disinformation coming out of the University of California, which is endless. People's Park is a cesspool full of homeless people, full of addicts. Don't go there. It's dangerous. That's usually how it starts. So those of us who love the park get the chance to point out that, hey, addicts are some of the best people in town. At least I feel that way. And every park has its share. And that People's Park is a wonderful place with a not just a renowned history. It's a landmark and deserving of that status. And we'll, you know, I start from there. Then if they want to ask more about it, we start talking about the fraudulent use of eminent domain, which everyone concedes. There's a reason why the University of California doesn't like that part of the story. So
there is an
embarrassing part of the story. Glad to go over it. I mean, in 1967, the land that is now People's Park was full of houses. And it was full of houses mostly with students and young people who were just working class in town. So there's a lot of music, drugs, rock and roll, free sex. People were exploring. I mean, there was gay culture. There was a lot of, like, really rocking new culture happening in San Francisco and over here, especially on Southside. And they couldn't stand it because they would bring these, you know, people would come, their rich donors would come and see all this tie-dye and wild Summer of Love style stuff. They just couldn't bear it.
And not just that, but also anti-war and anti-racial discrimination.
Anti-war, yeah, it was like a big activist center and a lot of underground zines, a lot of, I mean, it really was a rockin' place to be, and tons of newspapers. If you were a journalist like me, you could get published all over the place. So they decided that they really, really, really needed that land and acquired it through eminent domain because they're well connected at the state level, bulldozed the houses in the middle of finals week, thank you. And then the regents, now the regents are system-wide. They're not Berkeley-based. The application for funds to then develop that land into, oh, they had a lot of different ideas, but it was pretty loose. It was going to be maybe sports courts, maybe housing, maybe office buildings, I mean dorms or office buildings. But it was really loose, and what the regents did, it was so smart, they looked at the vacancy rate, and they said, what? You've got plenty of housing. You've got tons of empty office space. You got sports courts up the wazoo. I don't think you're as needy of the system-wide funding as these other campuses, and so they wouldn't vote them any money to actually develop that land. So it sat empty. And after a couple of years of that, the people around there, notably including Michael Delacour, one of the park founders, had enough of rebar, broken glass, and having to crawl through just this nutso remnants of the bulldozed houses. So they got some shovels together and built a park. And that's how it all began. People got together and out of their own pockets and with their own sweat, user developed People's Park into the park it is today. And the University of California never stopped trying to battle back and reclaim it in that territorial way it has. But then we just go in and rip up the asphalt and reclaim it back for the people. And so that's sort of the story. It really doesn't make it nearly as much sense as if you are digging with a shovel in your hand and planting flowers and just enjoying the music. You know, I've just seen magical things happen up there because the culture is really a do-it-yourself culture long before DIY became an acronym.
Huh. And, of course, things have changed since 1969.
Well, I'm older and grayer. I'm not sure what
too.
You mean.
Do you spend much time up there anymore?
Nope, because of the smoke. Now I have really crappy lungs, and the last time I played for the People's Park anniversary, they made sure the stage was smoke-free for me and the area around the stage, or did their best. But it's hard to be up there because there are people who honestly feel like they express their freedom through their cigarettes, and so it's hard on me. I hope that changes someday, but because I miss the park. I spent 2.5 years with David Nadell putting up storyboards about the park's origin every damn weekend, early in the morning till late at night. And that was a really worthwhile way to make sure each incoming group of freshmen and all of the tourists who came there were educated from the ground up by people who were there. And so I hope somebody's picking up where I left off and where David left off. And I hope someday it's a little easier for people like me to enjoy the park.
Has anyone created a good video of not just, you know, I'm interested in the whole history. In fact, I've got, you know, voluminous records of the park that I was putting together 20 years ago when we were all resisting the volleyball courts, the sports courts there. But has anybody done any good videos on the resistance of the park in the last 20 years, or the history of how that's gone down, the various back and forth with UCB and so forth?
Wow, not that I know of. Although each battle has a lot of good video on YouTube, which I hope somebody takes the time to assemble someday. I've certainly, I saved a lot of the coverage from local papers back when we had some, and just put them all in notebooks, and have been meaning to go through and then write. Like a lot of the coverage from the newspapers is inaccurate anyway, so it'd be fun to go through and just insert a piece of paper with my recollection of the day. But I haven't had time to dig out those notebooks in a while. I think they're in boxes by my car.
Oh, don't let them get moldy, Carol.
Oh, well, it's hard to know what to do with them. There is one good video of the earliest days of People's Park where they explain what I explained about how the regents wouldn't vote the money to develop the land, so it sat empty. But that's from 69, just after 69.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't something that I consider comprehensive since then that isn't kind of, like the People's Park book that Terry Campos put together is really absent any of the battles or any of the politics, and I think she did that on purpose so that everybody would think it was just this lovely, you know, nice garden of a place. And it is a nice garden. It's just that there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, and I hope that somebody can piece together those pieces. I'll be happy to contribute to whatever I've got if you ever find anybody interested in that.
That'd be so great. I wish that we could set aside a time when, we could take a look at what we have and try to figure out a good project with it. That'd be great. I'm glad you did your part in saving some stuff.
Yeah, let me know if you want me to store some of your stuff in that regard. I do have a little storage space down here, so we can do that.
Oh, phenomenal. Yeah. I'll take a look.
Anything, Carol, I know often, you know, subjects that aren't explicitly about homeless civil rights, but that have a significant impact on them, like developments in Berkeley and different kinds of funding going to the different, in the wrong places, has a real impact on poor people, both indoors and outdoors. Anything you want to comment on stuff that's going around in Berkeley in that regard?
I guess I'm feeling like the outlier in I am the human rights editor at Street Spirit, and I was sent the PDF of the April issue, and it made me really angry. I'm just going to be frank with you. You won't hear this from anybody else, probably, who works for Street Spirit or or enjoys it. But I'm kind of pissed off about the way U-Spirit Artworks, which is the new umbrella under which Street Spirit exists now, that's the parent organization and the fiscal sponsor. So I look at this issue, and the front page is written by the director of U-Spirit Artworks and promotes a program of U-Spirit Artworks, and that isn't the first time in the last year it's promoted U-Spirit Artworks programs and people and interviews. It's a, you know.
We should say that Street Spirit is not a commercial publication.
It's not a commercial publication. It does not take ads. It's supposed to be the voice of the people, and this is what bothers me. Whoever is the director of U-Spirit Artworks is not a homeless person on the street. That's, you know, and with all due respect to people who make $70,000 a year, and she probably makes more than that, that's not the people that it's supposed to illuminate. So I'm kind of pissed off that, you know, if you acquire control over a newspaper and then it's suddenly it's all about you and your family, your organization, and its programs, well, somebody ought to be knocking on your door and saying, hey, you know, the opportunism should be dialed back a little bit. So I tried to do that, talking to the editor and talking to this director of YSA, and I'm just getting bit, I'm just getting, like, dismissed and treated like I'm out of bounds. And then I turn a couple more pages, and, you know, they're not interviewing people who actually live in tiny houses. They're interviewing a New York architect who stands to gain, who makes a lucrative living selling the concept and pushing tiny houses and his sort of prefab version of this. And I just thought, really? Did you have to go to New York? Because... because all over here, you got tiny house promoters who are local developers and local homeowners who want to turn a quick trick off their own backyard, like your former, or maybe he's still on the city council. Is it Posner or one of them?
Michael
had
Posner.
Had a backyard shed he was making $2,000 a month off of. You know, I got to say, I think this is a distraction from honest-to-God housing, and so I'm the last voice around here who is not charmed by the miniaturization of human need. And I was pleased at least to see in this article by the rich, wealthy New York architect, a quotation from Obama's head coordinator of homeless services, who said, you know, the same thing I'm saying. This is a distraction. You can't call this housing. This is not technically housing under any city's definition of housing, because it has no running water, has no facilities, has no heat. Landlords can't do that unless they use this tiny house as the nose under the tent, the camel's nose under the tent, to loosen restrictions and regulations so that landlords, you know, are rubbing their hands together in anticipation of being able to build even smaller and less livable units. Micro units, they're called by Patrick Kennedy, and some people prefer tiny homes. All I'm saying is that even jails, at least in California, even jails have minimum square foot requirements. So I'm very upset that there appears to be very little recognition of the deception in this movement.
You know, it reminds me of, and I've never tracked down the accuracy of this claim, but the claim I heard some decades ago that the laws in New York City, I believe it was, or maybe it was nationally, probably New York City, because I think it's a state issue, or New York, the state, the laws regarding the requirements for shelters were significantly changed in order to allow for warehousing of people in these shelter programs that arose in the 80s, rather than continuing to build necessary housing, of course, which is discontinued under Reagan. But that actually was the stage was set for that before he came into office.
That's interesting.
And I don't know how accurate that is. If you learn more about that, if anybody out there is listening to this program does, please give me a call at 423-4833. And remember that this is a pitch for a satirist with whom I usually agree and sometimes don't, Carol Denny, who I'm talking to on the phone. You can be found online at, give us the website again, Carol.
Oh, it's just CarolDenny with an EY .com. And I'm glad to talk to anybody who's, I don't know, interested in these issues. I think that we will probably always be a smaller ratio of any given population, but if we work together, we can accomplish more.
Now, is there, and are there other websites where you get information that you think is, well, of course, you're local to Berkeley and I'm local to Santa Cruz, but maybe that kind of says it, but, you know, in the California area, are there websites you go to that you think are more productive than others?
I guess most of what I write is about local issues. So where the website I spend a lot of time on is the Berkeley website, City Berkeley website. And I have gone to the City of Santa Cruz website to get, you know, the straight-up law so that I can write articles about it. I also, in terms of what's national, go to the Southern Poverty Law Center website and take a look there. They do marvelous work, and also the ACLU and Amnesty International. All of these civil rights issues sort of overlap in a lot of ways. So I'm just really, really glad you're interested and that people are paying attention. What bothers me about Santa Cruz and Berkeley is that the people on the city council, in a bright red state like West Virginia, they would be considered wildly radical liberal people. But in truth, what's happening with housing seems to have no partisanship about it. People think nothing. As a matter of fact, if you pick up the San Francisco Chronicle today, there's a columnist named David Talbot who wrote this Hearts and Flowers column about how he tricked someone who was adamantly opposed to a navigation center in her neighborhood and was putting up flyers about that into sitting down with the city council rep or the San Francisco supervisor who was promoting the navigation center.
Explain what a navigation center is, Carol.
Oh, well, I'm not sure I know what it is, but it's apparently the place that they force you to go when you got no place to live. After they've taken your tent away, they send you to the navigation center. It's supposed to have, quote, services, but it'll never have housing. It's the substitute for housing, and I have a low opinion of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know what, up in these hills behind me, all over the Berkeley Hills, there are really people just dripping with wealth who are mentally ill, who are addicts, but nobody's worried and bothered by that because they have a house of their own. So I feel like every addict that we got on the streets of Berkeley, give them a house of their own. Then you won't be worried about it. I just feel like this is all really about the visibility of poverty, and that's what disturbs me about the little article that I saw in the Chronicle today where, you know, both parties, the San Francisco supervisor and the woman who was opposed to the navigation center, ended up arm in arm over the assumption that once they've built a navigation center, they will have a legal excuse, and this does exist under the law, to do what is now under most legal theories, unconstitutional, just shovel people in there, whether they want to go or not. And it bothers me. That bothers me immensely. Because we did not have, when I first came to Berkeley, if you saw somebody in a doorway, sleeping in a doorway, the first thing you would have done is gone over to him and said, hey, buddy, are you okay? You know, you need something? Are you hungry? And you'd take them home and give them a bowl of soup and figure out what they needed. You would never just walk by. And I'm serious when I say that. I try to tell that to the young people in town here who probably never experienced that. They grew up in this world where, yeah, you walk by 20 people on the street in a given morning and think nothing of it. That is a world we can change. You know, Berkeley, this is the richest nation on earth, no question. And then this town, I think Santa Cruz might be in the running for this too, but this town is among the top 10 for income disparity in the nation. So there's no excuse not to house the poor. So, you know, I yap about this, and I am very unpopular as a consequence.
Not with everyone, Carol. Thank you for extending what was supposed to be a 10-minute interview to...
Sorry.
Not at all. That was my fault. I kept throwing questions at you. Thank you. And if you decide you want to do your own radio show again, as you did some decades ago, although it was a wonderfully satirical show, and I guess satire is a great way to go with this stuff.
It is a great way to go. Yeah. I really love being Laura Drawbridge. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you feel like it, we have, you know, if you decide you want to throw some of your latest criticisms onto an audio file and send it down here, we'll play it on free radio. So.
Oh, what a lovely offer. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. And, or some music. Rumor has it you're also a singer of some kind.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Carol. And your last words on this, if anything?
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for the people of conscience in the city of Santa Cruz. I know you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, I guess so. Hey, have a good night, or a good day, actually. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for another marathon session of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. That was Carol Denny. Again, you can find her at caroldenny.org, I believe. That's D-E-N-N-E-Y, or browse for Carol Denny. You should find it. I enjoyed her singing. She and I get into it. She's a great source of information on Berkeley and has strong and moving and sometimes frightening views. Not because the views are frightening, but because it's sometimes a challenge if your views are different than hers. That can happen too. But I've known her for decades, and she's been working on these issues for decades and exposing hypocrisy and injustice up there. And good for her.